So we're in the fourth step. My name is Carrie. I am an alcoholic. My home group is the New Horizons group. And my sobriety date is March 25th, 2010. We're on the fourth step, and we're on page 67 at the bottom of the page on fear. So we're going to go ahead and just, I'm going to read through it. There's not a whole lot to the fears inventory, to the fears section in inventory. So I'm going to just read through it. So notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. We went through the diagram on page 65 last week. And that's what that's referring to. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set into motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. That's why I make a fears list, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So these are some of the fears that I noticed that go on my fears list. There are things that the resentment list didn't catch, right? And so that's why now I'm making a fears list as well. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem, nor any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there's a better way. Ah, the solution. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. I have that highlight. What does infinite mean? What does finite mean? Well, infinite means endless, right? It means infinity. It means no limit, limitless. Finite means I have a limit on what I can do. You know, I can't fly. I can't create a tree. I can't, you know, I don't make the ocean go. I have limits on what I can do, my finite self. So I have to find a power greater than myself, which we did in step two. Well, we became willing. And then in step three, we're going to let that power, be in control. We're going to let him be the director, right? He's the agent. We are his students, all that stuff. And that's what it's talking about here is now really there's nothing to fear but fear itself, right? I don't know if you guys remember that song. So we are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as he thinks that we would, I'm sorry, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us. And humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? I've heard in meetings before that you can't have fear and faith at the same time. I don't believe that at all, not even for a second. Like, why would we need courage? Why would we have to have courage? If you couldn't have fear and faith at the same time. My sponsor is very adamant about this fact. She's funny. My sponsor's funny. My sponsor is so humble and she's so, you know, she has much more humility than me. And she's soft-spoken and, you know, but once in a while, some things will get in her, you know, are her pet peeves, and that's one of them. And it's so funny because she has such few pet peeves, unlike myself. And she, you know, and she tells me we wouldn't need courage if we didn't have, if we didn't have, you know, fear and faith. So when I'm in fear about something, I have to have faith in order to walk through it. Or else I wouldn't need courage, right? I wouldn't need to practice faith. I would just be fearless, and probably a bit destructive, even more so. So I like that phrase there. just to the extent that we do as he think we would, as we think he would have us, and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity, which means I can still have serenity. Serenity doesn't mean, and I saw this thing on Facebook years ago, and it just kind of stuck with me. And every time I read this paragraph, it reminds me of it. It's some corny, I forget what, how it goes, and I'm sure I'm going to botch it, but here it goes. Serenity is not freedom from the storm. It's finding peace standing in the rain or something like that. I mean, it sounded good on Facebook. Anyway, we never apologize to anyone for depending on our creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage, right? Means courage. We wouldn't need courage if we didn't have faith, if we didn't have fear. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. Now notice that this is not a promise in the big book. A lot of people label things promises that are not promises. This is not a promise. What this does not say, I'm going to read it the way that I heard it the first time I read it. This is what it does not say. It does not say we ask him to remove our fear and at once we are without fear. It doesn't say that. It says we ask him to remove our fear, direct our attention to what he would have us be, right? So we're not stuck in that fear. We got to direct our attention over here. Like, who can I help? What can I do, right? What action can I take? And at once we commence, which means we begin to outgrow fear, not at once, poof, the fear is gone. Commence means begin, you know? And this is where it's not an overnight matter, right? It's not, I mean, this stuff takes a while and sometimes a lifetime, and that's okay. Because the more I pray for the fear to be gone, the more I pray, for God to remove that fear and direct my attention to what he would have me be, the more it becomes habitual for me. And new behavior is extremely uncomfortable for someone like me. Extremely. The first time I said this prayer, it did not work and it was extremely uncomfortable. But today, the reason why it's become more comfortable and the reason why it actually works today is because it's not new behavior anymore. Now I have done it enough to where it is a practice. It is a natural response that I go to. It's no longer uncomfortable because it's no longer new behavior. So that's the fear prayer. That's the prayer that, when I am in fear, doubt, worry, any of those things, when it comes up, I, that's what I pray. And every time this book says we ask him, it means that that's a prayer, right? And so I say, God, please remove this fear, and I will put a word to it most of the time, remove this fear of what my daughter is doing tonight after my husband gave her permission to be out, and direct my attention to what you would have me be, right? And I begin to outgrow fear. So not an overnight matter. So now about sex. All right. Many of us needed an overhauling here, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex, sex, and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. Page 69 at the top. Maybe that's a joke. Yes, sex is on page 69 in the big book. Ba-dum-bum. Okay, so they think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his flair, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. Listen up, guys. This is direction, clear cut direction for the sponsor. This is not talking to the new prospect. This is telling the sponsor, mind your own damn business. This is telling me I am not the arbiter of anybody's sex conduct, nor do I want to be, right? Nor do I want to be, because half of the people, like it just says, are on this end of the extreme, and half of the people are on this end of the extreme. You know what? I, at the same time, this is no joke, and I know why now God has done this to me, for me, whatever, because so I can share it with you guys. Because at the time, I'm like, is this some kind of a joke? Like, a few years back, four or five years back, I was sponsoring two women at the same, I sponsor a lot of women, and that's the only reason I can talk about specific sponsees, is because there's no way you can guess who is who. Or if I only sponsored two or three women, I wouldn't talk about them. So with keeping their anonymity, I was sponsoring this woman who, she was married. She's only been with one man her whole life. She was not on a straight pepper diet. I will put it that way. Not even on his birthday, if you know what I mean. Okay. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm sponsoring this other woman at the same exact time. This woman is a dancer. I'm not going to go into what type of dancing, but if you pick up my gist, okay, this woman is a dancer. And she's in a open relationship, which means her and her husband, they did eventually get married, sleep with other people, and they are okay with that. I could never do that in a million years. That's just me, right? The other woman that I was sponsoring, who not even on her birthday will she get on her knees, not even on his birthday, I was going to say, that, you know, that woman in it, this is unbelievable. But out of the two, guess who had the problems in their sex relationship? Unbelievable, you know? And so who am I to tell somebody what their ideals are? These are not the sponsor's ideals. The sex ideals are each individual, and I don't get to tell anybody what's right or wrong. The next paragraph will tell us what's right or wrong. So, so this is directions to a sponsor. Again, you know, one school would allow no man flavor for of his flair or whatever, and the other school would have us on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I have that highlighted. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? We reviewed our own conduct over the past. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Now, these are the questions that I had to ask both women in a period of probably within 30 days from both experiences were having some issues. Both women, I had to ask this question to: where have we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom did we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? It wasn't the stripper who was arousing bitterness. It wasn't the stripper who had been dishonest, who had been inconsiderate. So just because I want to judge people, you know, it was actually the dancer who was extremely honest, extremely considerate, who never aroused jealousy. And I wanted, my natural response was to judge her. My natural response. But her and her husband had an amazing, they still have an amazing relationship. Wouldn't work for me, does not mean that I get to be the arbiter of what works for someone else. Does not mean that. So those are the questions that I have to ask myself when I'm doing a sex inventory. Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? We got this all down on paper and we looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. Future is the word I have highlighted there, and I'll tell you why. I hear this stuff, and I have since I got sober in meetings like, you don't get into a relationship in your first year because you're so much more mature at 366 days than you were at 365 days, right? Like you're so much more sober. And I've heard stuff like, keep your legs closed for 90 days or all this stuff. I don't know. I don't know. If you get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not talking about the meetings, but if you get into this work, somebody with maybe 4 months under their belt who has done a thorough and honest searching and fearless moral inventory and has done this work in this sex inventory, I don't know, maybe they're more prepared than somebody with 2 years who hasn't even started a sex inventory. So for me, the only time frame that the big book gives is right here in this sentence. In this way, we tried to shape a safe and sound ideal for our future sex life. So I don't tell anybody when I start to sponsor somebody, oh, you need to not date for a year. I don't tell anybody, you need to keep your legs closed for 90 days. I don't tell anybody any of that stuff. I try not to tell anybody what to do at all in the first place. But what I will suggest is, before you start getting into relationships or getting out of a relationship for that matter, if you think you need a divorce or whatever, why don't we do your fourth step first? Like let's get your inventory on paper so that you know what you're working with, so that you know if you even have anything to offer somebody else, right? Right? And that sometimes can be an incentive to somebody new who wants to date. That'll get the boot on the butt to kind of get moving on the steps. So, but that's the only place in the big book that I have seen a kind of a time frame for myself as far as a sex life. It uses the word future. So, assuming that that's I'm inventorying my past so that I know what I have that I'm working with moving into my future, and I know what my sex ideal is. So we subjected each relation to this test. Where was it selfish or not? Here's another prayer, because it says we ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. So once I have my inventory, and then the side that says what should I have done instead, that is my ideal. For me, not when not the or the person I'm working with, that is their ideals for them, right? And so I get to through inventory shape a sane and sound sex ideal, and then I get to look at that and I get to pray and I get to ask God to help me to become that, help me to live up to that. We remembered always that our sex powers, I love that term, sex powers, were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. And that word sex powers, it reminds me that I should also mention, for those of you who are new or nearly new at this work, the sex inventory, it really isn't about intercourse, it's about interaction. It's not necessarily, I don't list everybody who I've ever had sex with. I get to list people who, I've hurt because I mean, we're women, right? When we're out drinking, we do what we want to do to get our way, So what have I, who have I led on? Who have I not, like all of that stuff, all those games, that stuff goes on there. Like we're trying to see a pattern. And it doesn't necessarily have to be people that I've had sex with. It's people who I've had that interaction with. And if we're being honest with ourselves, we know who goes on that list. At least I did. I know who goes on that list. Whatever our ideals turn out to be, which is not the sponsor's ideals, right? We must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that in doing so does not bring, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem in meditation. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter, right? We ask God. We don't ask sponsor. We ask God what we should do in each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. This is reiterating and reiterating. It does not come from a sponsor's direction. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge, says a third time. And this is why, when sponsees call me and they're like, oh my God, he's not working a program, because that's what the most of my complaints sound like, because for some reason I get all these AAs that have spouses in AA too. And they're like, I don't get to tell them what to do and what not to do. I get to say, well, have you prayed about that? And I get to lead them back to these questions. I get to lead them back to where have you been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? And I know I can go back to page 69. Okay, I'll tell my joke, because I just told it at my home group the other day, because we were on page 96 and now we're on page 69. So I think I'm going to tell my joke again, for those of you who missed it. So this is where the sex part of the book is on page 69. And so there's this dyslexic, and I can tell a joke about dyslexic people because I'm dyslexic. So there. There's this dyslexic sponsee, and she's having troubles with her new boyfriend, who she found in her home group. And so she calls her sponsor, and she's like, oh my God, what do I do? He's not working a program, and he's got drunk again, and well, yada yada yada. And I don't want to hurt his feelings, and I like him so much. And she says, oh my God, you got to go to the sponsor says, you got to go to page 69. I'm not the arbiter of anybody's sex conduct. You got to go to page 69 and read those questions on page 69. Well, she's dyslexic, so she goes to page 96, and she reads up the top of page 96. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. So that's my joke. I love my joke. So I tell it as often as I can. Yeah, it just keeps on reiterating that God alone can be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical, and now I'm on page 60, about sex as others are loose. And you notice how they've said that four times now? Like they continue to reiterate that. And again, they remind the sponsor once again, we avoid hysterical thinking or advice. I don't know about you, but I am a control freak. This directions was written for me because I will tell my sponsee what I think they should do. And it's none of my business. It's between them and God. God alone can judge. So suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and we stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? You slept with somebody in your first 365 days. Oh my God, you're going to get drunk, right? Some people tell us so, but it's only half the truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we've done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe that we will be forgiven and we have learned our own lesson and we've learned our lesson, which is awesome because I don't get to take away somebody's opportunity to learn their own lesson and to pass on their own experience, which maybe could help somebody else. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. So to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray. So not just pray, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, just like any other problem in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? We throw ourselves the harder into helping others. That's the whole theme of this whole program. We think of their needs and we work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. Work with others, work with others, work with others. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We've listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we've hurt by our conduct, and I have that highlighted. And the reason I have that highlighted is because that's my fourth list. I do four lists. I do a list of resentments, and I inventory those, a list of fears, a list of sex conduct, and then I do a list of harms done. And the reason that I do that is the first time I went through this work, it was with a big book sponsor, and God bless her, it was word for word. And I am so appreciative of that. But we didn't do a harms done list. And a lot of alcoholics don't come in, you know, with my exact story. So if you can't relate, you can't relate. But the sponsor I have now, she does a harms done list. And why she does that is for people like me. Resentments, it was not that big, actually. Some of you guys are probably thinking, oh, well, that's because you're not being honest with yourself, right? No, it's because you can't really offend the offensive. And I came in having given a lot of resentments. I'll tell you that much. I still do. And I guess it's better to give than to receive when it comes to resentments. But, I didn't have a whole lot of people on my resentments list. I had a whole lot of fears. I didn't have a whole lot of sex. I had been married for 18 years. But the harms done that seemed to have slipped through those three, and I'll give you an example. I'm going to go ahead and I don't talk about this at group level. It's usually just one-on-one with a sponsee when they're on their fifth step, but I feel comfortable with most of you guys, and it's not that huge of a meeting. So I'm going to go ahead and in a general way, I'm not going to tell you the details because you'll hate me. I grew up in a really small town. And I see Chris on here. She's a sponsee of mine who I just told this story to. So she knows the whole story. I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to tell in a general way. But I grew up in a small town, and I was an asshole kid. Okay. And I was, I guess that you would term me a bully. There wasn't much to do. And me and my friends, there was this one boy, you know, and I ended up giving him, he had, problems. And I ended up giving him what used to be called crank. I think today it's called crystal meth, but in his orange juice. And not just one time, you know, and we thought it was funny to watch him go. And, Corey Mowen deserved to be on my list. along with a whole lot of other people that I was just as big of an asshole to. And how did he not make my first fourth step list? Well, because I wasn't resentful toward him ever. He's never done anything to me. I wasn't fearful of him ever. I never had any sex conduct with him. So he didn't make my list. So I do an additional list. It's a harms done list. And so it says we have listed the people that we've hurt by our conduct. And I needed to inventory that stuff. And I hate to admit this, but my harms done list was bigger than all three of the other lists combined. And I am so grateful that I've had the opportunity to clean all that stuff up so that I can look the world in the eye. You know, I'm so grateful that I've had an opportunity to make up for those harms done. So we've listed the people that we've hurt by our conduct, and we're willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope that you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Wow, ain't that an understatement? We're going to get into the fifth step. I think we're going to go ahead and get this 5, 6, and 7 done today, because that's like real time, right? So now we meet up, right? I usually will have the sponsee at my house. I've done it in the park a couple of times. I've done it on Zoom a few times now. I've done it, you know, in different places, but most of the time I invite the person who's doing this over to my house. And I have you know, planned a good 4 to 6 hours gap, and I have them bring all their fourth step over, and we just start reading from this point in the book. We say a quick prayer together. I ask God to allow me to be a conduit, and to allow God to speak through me, and to remove any sort of judgmental you know, face expressions that I might because I'm super expressive, and, you know, and then I ask God to help. I pray for the woman who's telling me her fifth step too. And I pray, and I ask God to help her to be, fearless. And so then we start reading, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? Well, we've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on our weak items, on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in italics. And whenever the book has the steps in italics, that means we're about to start that step. So in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. So this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing defects with another person. We think we've done well enough admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. I call these the fifth step threats. if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And those who don't like to be threatened can call these warnings, fifth step warnings. I'm trying to be sensitive. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Here comes another warning. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they've turned to easier, softer methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. So having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they have never completed their house cleaning. Yeah, we complete this stuff. I have the word completed highlighted on the previous page, page 72 and page 73. Up until the 10th step in this program of action, that word completed is all over this. I mean, I get to complete these steps. These are the steps we took. Can't keep tooking them. Obviously, until steps 10, 11, and 12. And then that's when the language flips and all of a sudden it's not what we did and how we did it and what we prayed. Now it's what we do and what we continue to do. And it's not an overnight matter. And this should continue for a lifetime. And you hear all that stuff, sort of stuff. And that's why those are called the maintenance and growth steps. So they took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egotism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense that we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Could you imagine? I mean, think about it. Those people who say that they take the 12 steps every day, they tell someone else that all their life story every day, like that poor sponsor, right? You have to hear the same story every single day. That would be miserable. I think they're talking about practicing these principles in all of their affairs on a daily basis. But taking these steps, I take much more seriously than just saying it's something I do every day. I wake up, I pee, I take the steps, and then I have my coffee. Nope. These are some pretty big life-changing actions that I took when I took these steps. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents a stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes those memories far inside of himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. This is not stuff we do in our sobriety. This is stuff we do when we're about to take our fifth step. You know, this is early recovery here. If you want to get deeper into these principles in steps 10, 11, and 12, wonderful, but please don't call it steps 4 and 5. That's diminishing the seriousness of this stuff. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have such a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance for recovery, I'll say. We go to them for help and then we lie to them. We must be entirely honest with someone if we expect to live long or happy in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before choosing the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. You know, and well, I'll continue. Those of us belonging to religious denominations, which requires confession, must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority. I am perfectly fine with, you know, if there's one place that I suggest, in my experience, and there's only been two women. So there was only one example that I remember asking someone, maybe you should go to your, in one instance, it was a rabbi and the other, it was a Catholic priest, but if the statute of limitations isn't up yet, and there's something that legally you probably shouldn't tell me, or else I'm legally, you know, I'm not a sponsor, isn't, we don't have the same legal rights as some of the people like your attorney and whatnot. So there's things that I have had women I sponsor take to the appointed authorities, not authorities, but you know what I'm saying. But that doesn't happen that often. It hasn't for me. I've sponsored literally hundreds of women, and it's only happened to me, with me twice. So it's kind of a rare occurrence. I'm thinking that happens. There's one highlight on this page that I don't want to miss, because I do want to get to the meat of this, but there's one highlight that I don't want to miss. And that is, the rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. I'm telling you, I really didn't understand this. When I got to AA, of course, I hit out in a lot of women's meetings, but I heard a lot of things like self-care was a big one. Love yourself. Positive thinking, self-affirmation. I mean, I heard a lot of stuff that I haven't been able to find in this book yet. And although those are wonderful things to learn in the Al-Anon family groups, you know, it's not AA. And I had to deal with my alcoholic problem before I could go to the graduates program or whatever else you guys want to call. I've heard Al-Anon family groups called everything under the sun. And I actually did do 2 years in Al-Anon after I was 4 years sober. And I love that fellowship. And so I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying it has a place and it's not AA. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. I have that highlighted because I have to remember that I'm a blamer. I want to be hard on you and not have to look at me, but that doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't do anything for my spirituality. It doesn't do anything for my honest inventory. I don't grow from learning from your mistakes. That's just not how I grow. So, top of page 75, when we decide who's going to hear our story, we waste no time. We have written inventory and are prepared for a long talk. Again, I feel really sorry for the sponsors of people who take this fifth step every day. That'd just be terrible. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged in a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by your confidence. We pocket our pride and go to it. A lot of people call this the fifth step promises. I love that they're called the fifth step promises. It's the only set of promises in the entire book that, if I'm being honest, I have to tell you, didn't come true for me right after the fifth step, which I didn't expect it to. But I kind of was like, aha, I knew this thing wasn't working the way it was supposed to, right? And then God has a sense of humor because the ninth step promises, like for me, happened almost identical. Like by the time I was halfway through my ninth step promises, that stuff had started coming. And then as soon as we were on the page that I read the 10th step promises, those had materialized. And then by the time I got to the 12th step, like so all of the other ones, but these didn't come until a while. I don't know what that's about. These ones came slowly to me. They didn't come miraculously fast like it reads here, but that's just my experience. And I've also sponsored women who have been able to see these promises happen like instantly the way the book reads. So that's cool too. But I'm just sharing my own personal experience just in case somebody else has had the same experience with me and you're like, well, what did I do wrong? I don't know, because I must have done something wrong too. It didn't happen that way for me. So let me read these because they're beautiful. Even if it didn't happen for me right away, they're still beautiful. We pocket our pride and go to it, eliminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, We are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Oh, so beautiful. So that's where I stop reading when I'm taking someone through this work. And that's where they start reading to me their inventory. And the way we took inventory when we started the fourth step I was explaining is from top to bottom, right? One column first, then the next column, then the next column. But the way we read inventory is from right to left. And so I just listen to the fifth step by asking the person taking their fifth step to read from right to left and read their inventory. All the while I'm listening for certain defects to make sure that if they don't catch them and they're not seeing them, that I can ask the proper questions to get them to maybe answer with the proper answers. honestly, you have given me spiritual consent to help you take your inventory if you're asking me to do this. So I do write some stuff down during your fifth step that I give to you, no one else. I just give it to you. But I am willing to help you with that inventory because that's what you've asked me to do. So after we do this, then it says returning home, we find a place we can be quiet for an hour. It gives such clear-cut instructions. It doesn't say 45 minutes. It doesn't say an hour and 15 minutes. I'm not going to lie to you. I wish, because I am such a literalist, that I can say that I sat there for 60 minutes. And I didn't. I made it 45. Oh, I wish like crazy, because I'm so anal about this stuff that I can tell you, I wish, really wish, and especially looking back on it now, I think I would have forced myself to sit through the last 15 minutes just so that I could tell you guys that I made it 1 hour exactly the way it says in the book, but it's not, that'd be a lie. So I'm very, again, I have a hard time sitting still. I have a hard time. So I made it 45 minutes, but returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Carefully reviewing what we've done, we thank God. So what do we do in that hour? Well, it tells us, again, clear-cut instructions on what we do for that hour. Carefully reviewing what we've done. So now I'm going down my list of resentments, right? And when there's one on there that still feels, ooh, that I can still feel, oh, I felt that name. If I can still feel that name, then I go to the resentment prayer. Right. And I take that to prayer in this hour of meditation. And I go down my list of fears. And when I feel that fear, I'm like, ooh, that one I need to pray and ask God to relieve this fear and help me to be more of what he wants me to be. And then the same with sex. Like I go down the names and if I still feel one, I got to go to the sex prayer, you know, and I pray for the next, for the right ideal for, I do exactly what it says to do. And then when I'm all done going over and reviewing, carefully reviewing, which is what it says here, carefully reviewing what we've done, we thank God from the bottom of our hearts that we know him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page, which contains the 12 steps. So I go back to page 59. Carefully reviewing. And again, I can't even tell you how many times this says carefully reading the first five proposals. We ask if we've omitted anything, for we have been, are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? So We got to carefully review those first five proposals. Those are the first five steps on page 59, right? So now I'm going to turn to 59, and this is what I'm going to ask God in my meditation time in that hour. I'm not going to ask him about we, okay? Let me just clear something up real quick. These steps are not written in the we because it's a we program. I mean, it sounds great and it's cute, but it's not true. Okay, so the re reason why why these steps are written with the word we is because there were more than one person who took them. And this book is the experience of the first 100 members or 70 members or whatever. But this book is the experience of more than one person. And if you go to the stories, including Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, they don't talk in the we, they talk in the I. The reason why these steps are written in the we is because they're more than one person's experience. And this is really controversial. And I'm sorry if you have to put me on your 10th step tonight, but it's not a we program. It's a we fellowship. And thank God it's a we fellowship. It's one, the we part is a third of the whole program, right? It's a third of the triangle. But this is not a we program. I don't have to admit that you're powerless over alcohol. I don't have to, take a searching and fearless moral inventory of hours. I have to do it for me. I have to stay in my on my own side of the street, and I have to do my own inventory. And these steps are between me and God and my sponsor. So if you want to look at it like that, you could call it we, but that's not what this term means. The we in these steps does not mean we of Alcoholics Anonymous. It means the first 100 had to do this. And if it was just one person writing these steps, then it would say, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. And that's what I have to do when I carefully review these first five proposals, is I have to turn them into I statements. And I have to ask myself, carefully reviewing these, have I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable? Yes, I think I did that. Have I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity? Yeah, I think so. Have I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him? Not as we understand him. Again, it's me. Have I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself? Yeah, I have. Okay. And did I admit to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs? Not of our wrongs, my wrongs. Yeah, I did. I did these things. So the next page starts out, if we can answer to our satisfaction those first five proposals, right? Then we look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted objectionable? Now, these things should still be extremely fresh in my mind, because I just admitted to enough to God, to another human being, these objectionable things. And my sponsor just helped me to find these objectionable things. So they should be super fresh, right? Like this, I don't understand people who say, that they're on their sixth step. Like, people who introduce themselves in meetings and say, well, right now I'm currently sitting on a sixth step. It's like, huh? How do you do that? Like, there's a whole 2 minutes between steps five and seven. I mean, what, how? But whatever, maybe they're working out of a different book. This book doesn't really give me that kind of time, but so it says, can he now take them all, every one? So this stuff is still super fresh because I just did my fifth step, right? And returning home, I took this book down from the shelf, and I went over those first five proposals. I have my list of character defects, and I'm ready, right? And if I still cling to something that I will not let go of, we ask God for God to help us be willing. So if there's still a character defect and I'm going down that list of character defects and I'm hating on my sponsor for one, because she helped me with that list, right? But I get down to one of them that it's like, ooh, I am not ready to let go of that character defect. But it says here that I pray for the willingness. So I pray for the willingness to be willing to let go of that character defect. I pray for the willingness to let God, to let go and let God, to trust and have faith and take this next step. And the next step is step 7, which when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And then here's a paragraph that always gets skipped over because people like to think that they're constantly on their 7th step. We have then completed step 7. I don't make this stuff up, guys. I'm just reading it. I mean, if you want to, you know, rewrite it, then that's great. But that's what it says here. We've completed step 7. So, you know, for years, and I'm just going to share this real quick before I open it up for questions, and we'll start on 8 and 9 next week. But for years, I was starting to have to put God on my 10th step, which he wasn't even on my fourth step when I first did the steps. But I was this 7th step. I thought I was doing it every day. I thought I was working on my character defects. I thought that was my job. I thought that, you know, 2 paragraphs in the big book for 6 and 7, BS. I need all this other help, right? So I'm reading all these extra curricular activity to help me with my 6 and 7, to help me, you know, work on my character defects. And God was not removing the ones that I wanted removed when I needed them removed. Now, why not? It's because I don't get to decide. These steps are really little in the book because they're not steps for me to do. These are God's steps. I don't get to do these steps. This is where I get to let go and let God. The work that I have to do that goes into 6 and 7, that takes place in steps 4 and 5. The work I have to do to prepare for 6 and 7, that's 4 and 5. These steps are so little in the book because I'm not supposed to decide when my character defects are removed. I don't know which ones are standing in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. I don't know. God knows. God's time, not mine. And I was getting very resentful to God because I was spending a lot of time and effort working on my character defects and nothing was going on. And I finally realized when I get the hell out of my own way, if I stop working on Carrie, like I have done quite enough of that, right? And I can start helping someone else. And I'm working with someone else, taking someone else through this work, watching miracles happen in someone else's lives. And I'm not working on myself. God has a way of coming in and working on me. God has a way of coming in and taking, you know, these character defects when he sees fit. But I can't tell him when, and I can't tell him which ones. I get to offer him all of me, the good and the bad. But it's not my business which ones he sees fit to take and when. And that is a huge burden for me. I missed the whole line where it says we have now completed step 7. I just have to become willing. Now, do I have to practice the principle of step 6 and 7 every day in my step 10? Yes, I do, but we're not there yet. Right here where we are in the book is I made a decision that I'm not in charge anymore, and I have become entirely ready to let God take what he wants from me. The end. Full stop. We have then completed step 7, full stop. And I'm so grateful for that today. I wish that I would have known that years earlier. So with that, I will open it up for questions.
Thank you so much. I'm doing the clapping because I love that. The other day when I heard clapping in the rooms, it was so good to hear. Oh, thank you again, Carrie. I'm glad I'm not alone, that I went through that same feeling, you know, thinking that I had to keep doing this, oh, and I had to do it myself. And I'm wondering why God wasn't doing what I thought he should be doing when he should be doing it, you know? So let me give you the first question I have. Now it's time, guys, to send in your questions. If you didn't already see that in the chat, please do so now. And we'll ask Carrie. We have the last 30 minutes reserved here for Q&A. So don't feel like we're being rushed on time. There's plenty of time. So can you describe a moment when you knew you had a character defect leave you, and how did you know and feel?
So I definitely have a moment that I can describe that comes to mind. If I had more time, I could think of probably a few more, but my biggest character defect coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, was attention seeking behavior. I am nothing less than an attention WH, and I still am. That has lessened substantially. And that was almost a character defect that I could say was almost out of my control. It was out of my control. Like, I remember, you know, at one point in my life before AA, they even put me on medication to kind of calm it down, you know, calm it down, Carrie. Like, the reason why I drank is because, well, I was born high, right? I drank to bring it back down. Like, I never liked getting high because I was like, I was high at my natural state. And so I do remember, a situation where it wasn't in AA. It was at my aunt's house at a family dinner. And there, something happened that could have really put the attention on me. And I knew that I would have enjoyed it. But I paused. I was definitely practicing my 10th step. And I paused and I thought about it. And I'm like, it's not my birthday. What would that, you know, lead to? How would that benefit anybody? And I was able to just keep my mouth shut. And it was something that actually really would have been hilarious. And I love being hilarious. but it was at someone else's expense. And I was able to just, you know, stop. And I remember thinking that night, how was I able to stop? I've never been able to stop myself before. And that's when I went, oh my God, God is doing for me what I could not do for myself. That is not a character defect I had been praying about. That is after I already realized that I need to stop working on my character defects. And God just, you know, I trust God. I rely on God. I wake up and every single morning, you know, I check in. I'm like, checking in for duty. What will you have me be? And I humbly rely on him to direct my thinking throughout the day. And in that, he removes those defects and I don't have to focus on them. I can focus on other people. And that stuff has actually happened now that I'm talking quite a bit. And even recently with some other character defects I have, there are things that I've noticed, like all of a sudden I'll be driving away from a situation and I'll start thinking, that is weird. Why didn't I react like I would have reacted years ago? And I start thinking, oh my God, thank you, God. That's another defect you have removed from me. Like, and it's super cool surprises. Now that I'm not working on it all the time, they're super cool surprises. You know, it's like, yes, my road has started to narrow. And I think that has a lot to do with working with others, because if I'm suggesting to someone else to behave in a way, I can't turn around and behave. You know what I mean? So a lot of it is just kind of that. But some of it is God actually removing my desire to behave in the way that I used to not be able to control. Not at all. And it's pretty cool, because once I let go, again, God has a way of doing what I could never do for myself.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to nod my head right off the my shoulders here. So it's awesome. Well, not nodding my head off my shoulders, but it's awesome being able to identify with that good stuff. Can an individual practice a step without having actually gotten to that step yet? Somebody asked. And by the way, your questions are anonymous, guys. So if you want to send them, no question is a stupid question, I guess. So there you go, except the one you don't ask.
So that's going to be, that's a more of an opinion, you know, and I know that a lot of people who I look up to, and who I respect would actually answer this question a lot differently than I am going to answer it for myself. I'm going to answer it based on my experience and the experience of women that I have sponsored. And that is no, the steps are in order for a reason. Yes, I'm talking about step 11 too, because prayer and meditation, absolutely practice prayer and meditation from the get, but that's not step 11. The clear-cut instructions in step 11 that are described on pages 86 through 88 only can take place after having done a step 2 and 3, because they're practicing the principle of step 2 and 3. And until I get introduced to a God, how am I going to grow that relationship? And I used to sit in meetings of the 11th step meeting, feeling like I was falling short, feeling like, because I heard people say, this is the step where you can start at all, any time. You can start this step before you even start step 1. Well, then why isn't it step 1? If that's the case, then why isn't it step 0? Why do they wait until step 11? And it's because I can't, you know, steps 10, 11, and 12 are the combined experience of all of the work I've done up until then. So if I haven't been through steps 1 through 9, if I haven't recovered from alcoholism, then I can't continue to practice the steps that I learned. I couldn't do it. And I've seen too many people beat themselves up trying to practice step 11 because that's what they hear in a meeting. And yeah, if you want to pray and meditate, wonderful. But the big book isn't just praying and meditating. It gives clear-cut instructions on the 11th step. And I believe that it's definitely designed to work in order. I believe that these pages, at least 1 through 103, the 12 steps are in order for a good reason.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Carrie. And there's some beautiful comments, and I'll get to them after our questions. So just so some of you that have chatted me know that I'm not ignoring you. So with that, did your sponsor help you identify your character defects in your fifth step?
Yeah. Yep, she sure did.
That's so cute. that's a reflective, yeah. do you recommend Drop the Rock to understand 6 and 7 for clarity? Somebody asked.
I love Drop the Rock. I love a whole bunch of outside non-AA conference approved literature. I love the 12 and 12. But for someone like me, I had to keep it simple and stick to the clear cut instructions. I didn't do that. And I paid the price. I think that if it would have been maybe the other way around, and I would have kept it simple in the beginning and just understood really that these are God steps and that they're not something that I have to put effort into, that my effort goes into 4 and 5 preparing for these steps, then probably, you know, around this time of my sobriety, I might be getting into those books and thinking, oh, this is really cool stuff, you know, because that it is cool stuff, but it's not the directions, and it doesn't help a newcomer to keep it simple and to get through these steps so that they can start helping others. And I, you know, again, if I had done it the opposite way around, I would probably be appreciating those books a lot more in my sobriety right now. It's just that I didn't keep it simple. And it really is so simple, and it really works. It really does just the exact way it says in the big book. I mean, for me, that's been my experience, is when I just do what it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, stuff just happens for me. It just falls into place. It's a miracle.
I love it. Thank you, Carrie. So let's see. If I remember something months after that should have been on my fourth, but I'm not comfortable talking about it to my sponsor. I'm not comfortable talking to my sponsor about it. What would you do with that?
I'm not going to offer any advice today, but I know that if I remembered something that I didn't purposely hide on my fourth step when I was telling my sponsor in my fifth step, but it came up after, I would absolutely tell my sponsor. And if it was something that I felt like I couldn't tell my sponsor, I would probably be looking for a new sponsor. I have to be 100% honest with somebody if I'm to live rightly and happily. Is that what I just read in the fifth step?
Sweet. That can bring me to tears. Thank you. Can we get a copy of this recording? Yes, we can. I'll be chatting the person that asked that. Absolutely. There's a link we have. I'll post in the chat as well. I've got people sending two different devices. Let's see. Have you ever sponsored someone who has no resentments that they are aware of? And how do you help them see something they can't yet see?
What a good question.
Resentment and fear, by the way.
What a great question. Yeah, I have. And it's really easy because it's like, so I use sarcasm a lot in my sponsorship, and a lot of people don't, you know, appreciate that. And so you probably wouldn't want me as your sponsor. That's just my style. Sorry. You know, that's why there's a wrench for every nut. But this is a really good place to utilize some sarcasm. I usually will ask the person who doesn't have any resentments, oh my God, you are so lucky. You have walked the face of the earth for almost 40 years and you have not run into a single asshole. That is incredible. No one has ever wronged you. God, I wish we could all be as lucky as you, you know? And usually they'll start saying, well, yeah, I mean, you know, of course I've been a victim here and there, but I'm bigger than that person and I have forgiven them entirely. It's not their fault. They're so sick. Oh, okay. You're so much bigger. Let's put that name on that list.
That's too cute. I love it. So that's resentment and fear. Does that cover it? The person that asked, I'm looking for your shaking head.
And fear, fear. So mm-hmm. Fear, I don't normally use as much sarcasm, but fear is a lot of the time, all of any concerns fall into fear. So I just wait a couple of days and that same person will come to me with a concern. And, you know, fear always goes into three categories. For me, I mean, maybe one day I'll have a fear that comes up that doesn't fall into one of these three categories. And I'm open-minded to that. But so far, any fear that has ever come up for me falls into three categories. I'm afraid that I'm not going to get something that I want. I'm afraid that I'm going to lose something that I have, or I'm afraid of the unknown. And if it doesn't fall into one of those three categories, and so a lot of the stuff looks like resentment. It looks like sadness. It looks like selfishness, but what it really is fear. And so we break it down and I can ask those questions. If it's resentment, you know, then it takes maybe a series of two to three questions to pull that fear out of, you know, what is making you resentment? Oh, so you're fearful of the way that that's making you look. Okay. I don't know anybody without fear. I haven't met anybody yet without any fear.